Hi friends, this is Matt. It is the end of November and I have been sick, and you can still hear it in my voice. And I've actually been holding off recording this for a couple of days, hoping my voice was gonna get a little better. And it just sounds the same. So I'm just gonna go with it. You're gonna have somebody that sounds a little bit like a squeaky prepubescent teen talking at you. But I'm excited about this and I just wanted to get recording. So hope you enjoy it. This one is entitled Us, Those, and Them. So friends, have you been feeling entirely too calm recently? Feel like it's been far too long since you've gotten unreasonably angry at a stranger? Is there not enough cause in your life for anger and outrage? Allow me to introduce you to the internet. Oh, I worked so hard on that, and I love it. It can be hard to stay grounded when you're online. There's more than enough anger and fear to go around. On social media and in every comment section imaginable, there are more than a few gauntlets thrown down, more than a few would-be martyrs and zealots looking for a hill to die and kill on. Of course, you're going to come across some fights that seem worth fighting. But that takes a lot of energy, and it's easy to lose sight of true north when you're triggered in the midst of an exchange. As a general rule, I try not to expend energy reading things online that I know will make me crazy. But this is a general rule and not an absolute. And there are exceptions. Such was the case when I recently came across an article written by a conservative Christian organization. Now, if getting angry at something that a right-wing religious organization publishes seems a little silly, well, you are correct. And certainly, that organization has produced much more toxic publications than this article. But like so many things that trigger us, I had a dog in this fight. Actually, three. The article was outlining the dangers of progressive Christianity as a pathway to atheism. It wasn't particularly well written, and it wasn't particularly effective at making its central argument. But it did concern and make assumptions about three groups of people: conservative Christians, progressive Christians, and atheists. Now, I'll get to how those groups relate to my story in just a moment, but first, a small exploration of each of these groups and ideologies. Atheism, of course, is the disbelief in the divine or the supernatural. But it is worth mentioning that atheism as a worldview is as varied as the individuals who hold to it. Some atheists are anti-theist, leveling arguments against any belief in the supernatural, while others are more ambivalent about the role of faith and religion in humanity, without believing in it themselves. So like Dawkins would be an anti-theist, Alain de Botton, he sees a lot of value in religion without actually believing in any of it. Within the Christian ideologies identified, conservative evangelicism is probably the correct umbrella term for almost every Protestant church you can think of. If you pass by an established church building on your way to work, or if you've ever gone to a non-Catholic Christian church service, chances are good it was likely a conservative evangelical church. And finally, progressive Christianity is probably best identified as a recent reinterpreting of the Christian faith, which itself, must be said, has seen countless interpretations over two millennia. This reinterpretation is often in response to a discomfort with conservative evangelicism, and so it might have a focus on social justice or environmental stewardship or inclusion of repressed or minority voices. But since it's a reinterpreting, there are multiple interpretations, and everything is up for grabs. And since this term refers to an ideological critique rather than an actual organization, it's hard to find your local progressive Christian church building. Now, in light of drastically different interpretations, It's natural that the established conservative churches would want to identify the boundaries of what is and what is not Christianity. And this, I believe, is where the aforementioned article was coming from. An established organization looking for ways to establish the boundaries, writing to its base to say, see, those progressives are not like us conservatives, but they are like them atheists. This is an argument about who's in and who's out. And atheism plays the role of the ultimate boogeyman, because if you're an organization that decides the boundaries of how people interact with the divine, there is nothing scarier than someone calling out the truth that the divine may not exist at all. Now, in general, the language of us and them always raises my hackles. And hackles, by the way, I use that term all the time. It means the little hairs on the back of your neck. Shortcuts are always taken when you're dividing something as nuanced and intricate as people and their ideologies. And in this particular article, I was very familiar with the groups being depicted and divided. Over 7 years ago, my wife and I experienced our first late-term pregnancy loss. A little over a year later, when we had a second, even later pregnancy loss, it devastated us. In the days and the weeks and the months that followed, that devastation acted as an invitation to reevaluate everything. Before and during those losses, I attended an evangelical Protestant Christian church, the type of conservative evangelical church that I spoke of earlier. That church was filled with a lot of good people. All of them had their own biases, sure, and shortcomings, just as I did and still do. But many of those people had kind and generous hearts and had a willingness to try and make the world a better place. But after our losses, continuing to go to that church felt impossible. It could have been possible, I suppose, to keep going. To keep singing the happy worship songs about how God was in control and everything would work out to our benefit. To hear sermons of the love that God had for the world, but knowing that there was a particular understanding that that love looked a very distinct way, required a particular mental assent and specific language of response. We could have continued to bow our heads in prayer, no longer sure of how to pray or if anyone heard or cared. In short, it felt a lot like going through the motions, but it was exhausting, propping up the thing which no longer felt animated or alive. In my devastation and anger, I found the willingness to uproot everything that couldn't speak to the new reality that we found ourselves in. And we stopped. We stopped attending that church, stopped reading religious books, stopped singing religious songs, and stopped praying. We stopped everything. Anger sustained and animated me in those days. I was angry at God, angry at the aspects of my faith and the certainty that now felt offensive, ashamed of the now dawning realization that those aspects were offensive to other wounded and suffering people too. I returned to university to start my Bachelor of Nursing around the same time. And without meaning to, without an intentional decision, without a letter of reformation nailed to a church door, I began to gain great affection for secular humanism. As a profession within the empirical, data-driven medical model, which is not without its faults and biases, nursing is up close and personal with the human condition. The interplay between who the nurse brings to the bedside and how they interact with the obvious physical and mental suffering is a dance, and it is beautiful. The secular humanist argument that we need to be grounded in reality and yet work for the best possible outcome for each member of our species, and even other species that we share this earth with, captured me. It still does. A few years later, I was also invited back to a church. A much smaller church this time. A church also full of people with kind and generous hearts and willingness to try and make the world a better place. And also with their own biases and shortcomings. I had the same problems with the same happy, clappy worship songs, the same problems with the desire for certainty and boundaries around what and who the divine is. Even the questions of whether the divine or supernatural is real at all. But this time, I asked them. This time, I didn't pretend that I was okay when I was angry. And this time, over time, in a smaller circle, around friends that I trusted, I was honest. Secure in the belief that any question, honestly asked, with consideration of those around you, was worth asking. And slowly, over days and months and years, I began to see in those friends, and in my friends from my previous church, and in the books I began to read again, and in the podcasts I would listen to on my walks alone, a way to hold the tension of belief in and love for a relational center of the universe. A way that allowed and included the reality of suffering, the welcoming of mystery and doubt. Some of these friends and voices had even found a way to love the words and actions of Jesus. And some even had affection and reverence for the Bible, full of its contradictions and ancient, and often offensive, language. Now, I was and am keenly aware that there may be no relational center, that Jesus may have just been a man, and the writings of the Bible may reflect only our ancestors' interaction with the concept of the divine and each other. But the love that these people held for God, for church, for scriptures, for tradition, for each other, this was real. I borrowed some of their faith in the beginning and have slowly unearthed some of my own. Now, this is obviously a big lead up, but I include it because it really should be illustrated that every story is personal to someone. The article that made me so angry, it identified three groups of people, but it didn't do justice to any of them. The reasons for disruption of faith, dismantling and examining, deconstructing and reconstructing, are always personal. In the past 7 years, I have considered myself a conservative evangelical Christian. I have felt my old faith die and wondered in the dark if I was now an atheist. And I have sorted and sifted as I gently held a faith both new and ancient. When I first read the article, my original reaction was outrage. In trying to connect the common beliefs between two outlying groups, progressive Christians and atheists, I could feel that the author was reaching. The logic was flawed, indistinct phrasing was used but never defined. I set about writing pages and pages, like I've got like 5 pages of counter-argument to each of these articles' main points, identifying the holes in the author's logic. When I was finished, man, I felt that I had completed a thorough theological slam dunk on my unknown opponent. But who was it for? These pages of rebuttal. For the small group of progressive Christians that I might share it with? How was that any different than the original article speaking to its base? And what was the fruit of such an argument? To prove that progressives and atheists were actually in and conservative Christians were out? I was just redrawing boundary lines. Every time I came back to this piece of writing, I puzzled at it. The post was finished and it could be uploaded at any time, but I knew that it needed to be different, better, and I wasn't sure how. Eventually, I was reminded of a recent interview with the 2017 U.S. Poet Laureate,
Tracy K. Smith. After an evening discussing her work and reading some of her poetry aloud, a member of the audience asked Smith how to balance sitting down for poetry and outrage over the current racism facing black women in the United States. Tracy K. Smith is herself a black woman, and speaking to this moment, she would have been keenly aware of the racism and sexism all around her. It would be apparent just how divided and outraged the United States is. She would know the reasons and justifications for outrage. But this was her response.
I think there is a value to outrage. I think that it activates a kind of power that we can choose to act upon. In art, I think that outrage might lead me to the page, but it has to sort of go sit down somewhere else when I'm writing a poem. Because I really do believe this, a good poem isn't going to be the result of the certainty that drives emotions like anger and outrage. If I know I'm right and they are wrong, my poem is going to be a tract. But if I can say, what are the sort of weird spaces that are underimagined? What are the areas where I either am already perpetuating something that is part of what I envision as the problem, or what are the imagined spaces I can enter into where I have to get uncomfortably close to that problem? That's where something really, I think, interesting starts to happen.
The moment I heard those words, I wrote them down. I shared them with my friends. I've written them upon my heart and carried them with me. I knew they were true, and true for more than just poetry, true for all our creative expressions. True the way I wanted to think and write and create. And when I remembered those words, I knew what was wrong with my rebuke. My response was so certain. I knew it was a tract. Like she said, I was preparing for a debate, and I needed to be writing a poem. And the poetry, that weird and underimagined space, the places where I am uncomfortably close to the problem, these are always personal. The stories of our belief and disbelief, faith and doubt, leaving or returning, these are our stories. This is my friend who is now identifying as an atheist after spending his entire adult life as a revered member of a church. This is my friend who goes to a local church and wonders if she can continue to go there as the organization tries to determine how literally it should interpret a 2,000-year-old text. It's the author I'm reading who left the church for years and questioned everything and somehow has found a way back into cherishing being part of a local church. It's my friend who just took boxes of theological books to the thrift store because he just can't think that way anymore. And in a strange sense, this was the sum total of the best of my arguments, that the original article kept people and stories at too far of a distance so that it could label and sort them, that it was too certain of who was in and who was out to accept the ambiguity and complexity of those involved, that it reduced belief or disbelief to a mathematical result of proper or improper values. One of my favorite authors, Richard Rohr, has a quote that I think of often. The best critique of the bad is the practice of the better. When we are surrounded by boundary lines that offend us, by language that divides us, and narratives that make simple the complex, it's natural to be angry and outraged. But perhaps the practice of the better is not a debate, not a punching match, but a poem. And that poetry
that poetry is always found in the personal. Well, that's it, friends. Thanks for listening right to the bitter end. 20 minutes, that's a long one for me. If you want to check us out, of course, the website is somethingfromeverything.com. If you look, we also have a Facebook page. If you're on Facebook, search out Something From Everything. I threw this quote from Tracy K. Smith up there. Things that aren't quite developed enough to be a full post, or other people's work that I just want to share with you. So if you like any of this, check that out, and you can sign on, and then you'll see anything that I think is super cool. At the beginning, bringing me in is A.A. Alto's Constructivism. At the very end, bringing me out is K. Engel's Dagnement. Great copyright-free music that I appreciate. That quote from Tracy K. Smith that I just held the phone up to the microphone for is a live interview with On Being. It is called "Love is a Language Few Practice, But All or Near All Speak." I absolutely wholeheartedly recommend the entire conversation. It is wonderful. Anyway, until next time, reject the things that are simple when you know they're complex, and cherish the complexity of your story and the people around you. Take care of each other. Until next time, thanks for listening.